Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today, often we have guests, often we have specific clinical focus programs on health problems or specific nutrients. Today we're going to do sort of a midsummer potpourri. These are items that I haven't managed to fit into my weekend program. You get 2 hours of Intelligent Medicine each weekend, broadcast on radio, or you can listen to the podcast after we post them on Monday, or you can listen live on Saturday from noon to 2 p.m. But there are certain constraints. There's commercials, there's time limits. We have to fit in a lot of calls. Each week there's a surfeit of interesting stories that somehow end up on the cutting room floor. And many of these stories are quite fascinating. So I'm going to share some of these stories with you today. Starting with, I often get questions about loss of smell. People who have deterioration in their ability to smell. And let's distinguish that from a decrease in the ability to taste. Taste is actually a mixed bag. It has to do with the taste buds on your tongue, which are for salt, bitter, sweet, umami, and so on. And then there's smell, and together, the smell from your nose and the taste buds on your tongue, the net effect is that you can taste foods. I mean, many of you recognize sometimes when you have a cold, you completely lose your taste. Well, that's not because you're losing your taste buds. This is a little bit, you may transiently experience a little bit of what people who lose their sense of smell experience. And this can be dangerous. Loss of smell may be associated with chronic sinus conditions. It may be associated with the use of chemotherapy. It may be associated with the use of certain antibiotics. One of the more ominous connotations of a loss of smell is the potential for it to forecast a neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's, or in some cases Parkinson's disease or Lewy body dementia. These are all nasty conditions. So let's take a look at the evidence that links loss of smell to neurodegenerative conditions, because there's some interesting studies on that that just come out. First of all, I was very surprised to see that you can get a home test kit for your ability to smell. There's something called the UPSIT test, UPSIT. It's a smell identification test, and you can buy it online from a company called Sensonics. I'll give you their 800 number. It's 800-547-8838, but you can just look up UPSIT test, UPSIT, or go to the website at sensonics.com. And this is pretty cool. For $26.95, you can order a comprehensive 40-item test that is the only olfactory test on the market today that can be self-administered. It is the most reliable test, they say, 94% accurate, available. It provides an absolute indication of smell loss, which is referred to as anosmia, mild, moderate, or severe. There's even a way to detect malingering. In other words, some people faking it. Also, you get instructions in American, Arabic, British, Chinese, traditional or simplified, Dutch, French, German, Italian, Japanese, Portuguese, and Spanish. The only problem is, this sounds like it's for doctors because the minimum order quantity is 7 tests. So these are tests that, ENT doctors probably would be in a position to evaluate. You know, the suggestion is that, get this evaluated by an ear, nose, and throat doctor, because that's the part of the body that's, under investigation. So when you do a little further investigation about the UPSIT test, the reason it's called UPSIT, it's the University of Pennsylvania Smell Identification Test. University of Pennsylvania is a center for olfactory research. They say that this test has been used in the diagnosis of many diseases, including Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's. So, yeah, that's kind of a concern. So they say here that there are many central nervous system disorders that are associated with olfactory dysfunction, including Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease, Huntington's disease, Korsakoff's psychosis, which occurs in people who are deficient in thiamine, which is kind of interesting, schizophrenia, head trauma, brain tumor, AIDS, multiple sclerosis. When it comes to Alzheimer's disease, it's been suggested that Alzheimer's disease affects odor identification, odor detection. And so some studies have said that olfactory function and cognition correlate to the severity of Alzheimer's disease, and that therefore UPSIT is a very good clinical test to be able to determine the severity of Alzheimer's. So that's concerning. And then also UPSIT is used to diagnose Parkinson's disease. Smell dysfunction occurs in 90% of cases with Parkinson's, et cetera, et cetera. So what's the latest on these correlations? If you've lost your sense of smell or if it's diminishing, and that is possibly something you can objectively confirm with an UPSIT test, does it mean that you're going to come down with dementia? Well, there's a recent study that speaks to that. Here's the study. This was just presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference. Dateline Toronto, where they held the conference. A smell test may be able to help predict cognitive decline in dementia, but it's still a long way from clinical use, researchers reported. The UPSIT test, to some extent predicted development of cognitive decline, but questions about the test's specificity for distinguishing between different types of cognitive dysfunction dementia preclude its widespread uptake. In other words, it's not ready for prime time. The researchers write, olfactory deficits have been investigated as a biomarker tool for Parkinson's dementia with Lewy bodies and other types of dementia. So it could be an interesting marker of an early stage of a neurodegenerative process. But I don't think it's going to be very specific to Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's or other neurodegenerative disorders, according to Dr. Eliezer Maslia, head of neuroscience at the National Institute on Aging. So they assessed 84 older adults, some with symptoms of cognitive impairment, some without, average age 71, and they all had UPSIT testing of their olfactory abilities. And then they had more specific testing for what's called amyloid burden. See, now we're getting into the era where you can actually test for the presence of early signs of Alzheimer's disease, not just by, you know, asking patients, do you know who you are? Do you know where you are? Do you know what date it is? Do you know who the president is? I recently saw a patient who his wife brought him in because his memory is really failing and he's confused. And he did fine. He was asking him, you know, who are you? And he knew who he was. Okay, good. Do you know who I am? Yes, you're Dr. Hoffman. Do you know where you are? Yes, I'm in New York City. Do you know what date it is? And had a little trouble, but he got it right. He said, yeah, it's Tuesday. And then I asked him, who's the president of the United States? And it just stumped him. It just flummoxed him. And poor guy was, you know, all confused. And then his wife said, a black man. And he said, oh, Obama. But he says it shows that just he was at the threshold of cognitive decline and confusion. He was pretty intact, but, you know, had a lot of trouble. Okay, so patients were assessed using more precise tests. Now what you can do is you can use a spinal tap for the presence of amyloid protein. Amyloid protein is what accumulates in the brain in Alzheimer's disease. Or you can do specific type of PET imaging. That's a specific brain imaging for amyloid. So they also found that after 6 months of follow-up, 67% of patients had memory decline. They found that amyloid positivity predicted cognitive decline. So that's the brain imaging test or the spinal tap, but the UPSIT score did not. They found that patients with an UPSIT score that was very low were more likely to have memory decline than those with a score that was relatively good. So there was, quote, somewhat of a relationship between amyloid and UPSIT score, but they warned that there wasn't perfect agreement between amyloid status and UPSIT score. So then they did a second study. They looked at 397 patients from here in Manhattan, upper Manhattan, average aged 80. They followed them for 4 years. They had both a sniff test and an MRI. The MRI, in this case, measured the cortical thickness. That's a test easily available because it's not even so specialized for amyloid. It's just, you know, MRI that looks whether you're basically having brain shrinkage. Over that time, 50 patients developed dementia, and 49 of them developed Alzheimer's. They found that impaired odor identification, and to a lesser degree, the cortical thickness, were predictive of the transition to dementia. So this test kind of suggests there was a little bit of a benefit to checking for smell decline. The upset was significant for predicting cognitive decline, but there was only a trend for the cortical thickness. So actually the upset test trumped the MRI for predicting cognitive decline in this case. They say that the findings support the view that odor identification deficits are related to neurodegenerative changes during the progression of Alzheimer's. But once again, it was warned that using a smell test to detect Alzheimer's disease is far from clinical use, and there's still many steps needed in order to validate its usefulness. Maybe it could be part of the workup, but to depend entirely on a smell test to determine whether you're at risk for a neurodegenerative disease, particularly Alzheimer's or dementia, at this point, it's a little premature to say that that is ready for current use. So there you have it. The smell test is available. Multiple causes of smell loss, some of which, a small percentage of which may be predictive of neurodegenerative disease or dementia, senility, but not 100% correlation. Okay, so let's, you know, while we're on the theme of dementia, how about some things to fend off dementia? Well, you know, we've discussed this to a large extent, and it's a frequent theme here on Intelligent Medicine. Recently, we interviewed Dr. Dale Bredesen, who's one of the foremost experts on a multifaceted program to slow or reverse cognitive decline. And this is the real deal, because he took patients with early Alzheimer's and he had them work on a variety of fronts, take supplements, they changed their diets, they were also encouraged to exercise, they were encouraged to undertake stress reduction, they were also encouraged to work on sleep issues and address them, and ultimately it worked. But one of the controversial areas in terms of staving off or reversing dementia are brain games. Brain games. Well, you know, ordinary crossword puzzles classically, but now they have entire companies that are devoted to brain games. And in the crosshairs on this subject was Lumosity. Lumosity is a company that predicates itself on, you know, basically, it's like a brain gym. It's like calisthenics for your brain. You keep your brain active. It's like a muscle. If you don't use it, or lose it, your brain will lose its suppleness and its the strength of its ability to make neuronal connections, and it makes sense. However, it turns out that the evidence for doing brain activities, well, intuitively, certainly makes sense, right? You know, if you don't use your brain's going to turn to mush. Makes sense. That's an appealing idea. There is no real strong clinical evidence that all the brain games in the world will forestall dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, Lumosity, one of the leading companies in this field, just got reamed with a federal fine of $2 million to settle false marketing claims. This is a huge industry, but it's in the crosshairs. Now comes and you may have seen this, widespread media reports that suggest that they finally have nailed it with a brain game that really works. So this is the press coverage. The New Yorker wrote, quote, "No brain game had ever been shown in a large randomized trial to prevent dementia. That was the case until today." Why are they hailing this as a new advance? There was a study presented at, you know, I talked about the smell tests presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference. Many papers presented there. One paper suggested that a computer game focused on brain processing speed may be able to diminish dementia risk 10 years down the road. And then Time magazine chimed in and says the study provides, quote, "the strongest evidence yet for the power of brain training to reduce the risk of dementia." Sounds great. So yeah, all right. This is hopeful news for the brain games industry. And I looked at the game and it just looks very, sort of boring, but you know, it gets you to do certain tasks faster and faster and faster. So what's the real deal? I'm reading a critique of this study, here on MedPage entitled "Watch Out for Brain Game Claims." And they're skeptical of this study that was presented at the Alzheimer's Association meeting. What they say is, indeed, there was a trial. It was called the ACTIVE study, and it was supported by the National Institutes of Health, the National Institute on Aging, and the National Institute on Nursing Research. It was a huge trial. It lasted over 10 years. It consisted of over 2,700 healthy adults aged 65 to 70 who didn't have cognitive impairment, and they gave them different training regimens, or there was a control group that didn't get any kind of memory training. So the study showed that early improvements in memory wore off after 10 years of training, but effects on reasoning and processing speed remained. Whoa, that sounds good. That's hopeful. In fact, the results were remarkably strong, according to one author of that study, Jonathan King, PhD. So King says, he admits it's like the world's most boring video game. It can be difficult, and if you're the kind of person who wants to get faster and better, you'll pay attention, but it's not enticing. There are no Pokemon running around. The presentation, which was actually an oral presentation at this Alzheimer's meeting. So there's a bunch of scientists in a room, and they're reading these data, and they're claiming that the results are fantastic. One scientist who was present said they made very broad claims that I don't think were backed up. The whole presentation was like that. You were left walking away with your hands in the air, not knowing what to make of it. So they clearly, the results of the study could have a big impact on promoting what's called speed processing training, which is available online to subscribers. It's called Brain HQ Double Decision, and it's from a company called Posit Sciences. And so there's some aura of conflict of interest. Some of the scientists involved in developing this program and testing this program may have been beneficiaries of licensing and fees from the company that makes this brain technology. So the word isn't out yet. Does cognitive training reduce dementia up to 10 years later? There's still hope that we can develop better programs and scientifically validate them. But according to some skeptics, the results of these training programs may not be much better than they were for Lumosity. I mean, from, you know, I'll stand up for Lumosity in the absence of a spokesperson. They still claim that their technology works, The FTC, Federal Trade Commission, who's responsible for monitoring claims, came down on them and said, "No, you're hyping it up. You can sell it as an interesting thing, but you can't say that it treats a disease like Alzheimer's." They just didn't think that the studies cut the mustard enough to make a scientific claim. And continuing on the theme of the brain, this is a pretty amazing story. It has to do with the effect of green tea extract on people with Down syndrome. Down syndrome patients experience severe mental retardation, and there's little in the, pharmacopoeia of conventional medicine that can enhance their intellectual abilities. So it was with great fanfare that newspapers like the Daily Telegraph of England reported, quote, "Down syndrome can be treated with green tea." So what's the deal here? The study looked at not just green tea, but something called EGCG, a potent extract of green tea. And it was a Spanish study. They found some improvement in thinking abilities among people with Down syndrome who took a supplement of green tea, and who also had training. Okay, well, you could say, what's the training? But they also had a placebo group that did not get the green tea. They just got the training. So I think they compared a group that did training with green tea extract and one group that got training without green tea extract. It makes sense because Down syndrome patients respond to training, just like kids with autism. So they didn't give up on the training. It's just one group got EGCG. They used 24 cognitive tests. They found improvements in just three of the 24 tests, but that was significant. They actually did brain scans, comparing 10 people from each group. The study group was 43 adults got EGCG and 41 adults were given a placebo. So then they picked 10 out of each group and they did brain scans and they actually seemed to show more nerve cell connectivity in the group that took the extract. So what's the deal here? Well, this is an early study. It's a small study. It didn't show dramatic improvements, but it showed slight improvements. And the brain scan changes were promising, but not statistically significant. In other words, too few people in the study to establish that this was a robust improvement. But it's encouraging. The mechanism is unclear. I mean, there's certainly antioxidant effects, anti-inflammatory effects maybe of green tea. It's unclear precisely how green tea should specifically help patients with Down syndrome, but maybe, have limited effects in other conditions. But it's an interesting study and suggests that EGCG might be helpful. And, so I think really we need to do more studies looking at other potential interventions like high-dose B vitamins, for example. It suggests that patients with Down syndrome may have methylation problems. Also, high doses of DHA-rich fish oil, circulatory enhancers, perhaps like ginkgo, which have been shown to have beneficial effects in patients with vascular dementia. Not clear whether it would still work in Down syndrome, where there's not so much of a vascular component. Or things like Bacopa. Bacopa has actually been shown to improve attention. We need to do more large-scale, longer-running studies to establish, A, whether green tea extract really is useful alongside cognitive training for people with Down syndrome, and or other nutritional interventions. But wouldn't it be great if this pans out? The headline's perhaps a little bit too simplistic and optimistic, but maybe, just maybe, there's something to it. The study entitled safety and efficacy of cognitive training plus EGCG in young adults with Down syndrome, a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled phase 2 trial. Phase 2 trial means we've got to go through phase 3 and 4 for confirmation of that, and probably they're going to get some more grants because it's promising. Good stuff. All right, please stay with us because we divide our podcast into two parts, and in part 2, we'll take up more intelligent medicine stories that I've been meaning to share with you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.